She purses her lips and shakes her head slowly. You unwinds are all the same. You think that because no one loves you, then you can't love anyone. All right, then. If there's no one you love, then pick someone who needs to hear what you have to say. Say everything that's in your heart. Don't hold back. And when you're done, put it in the envelope and seal it. I'm not going to read it, so don't worry about that. What's the point? Are you going to mail it? Just do it and stop asking questions. Then she takes a little ceramic dinner bell and places it on the roll-top desk next to the pen and paper. Take all the time you need, and when you're done, ring the bell. Then she leaves him alone. It's an odd request, and Connor actually finds himself a bit frightened by it. There are places inside he simply doesn't want to go. He thinks he might write to Ariana. That would be easiest. He had cared about her. She was closer to him than any other girl had ever been. Every girl except Risa. But then, Risa doesn't really count. What he and Risa have isn't a relationship. It's just two people clinging to the same ledge, hoping not to fall. After about three lines of his letter, Connor crumples the page. Writing to Ariana feels pointless. No matter how much he's resisted, he knows who he needs to address this letter to. He presses his pen to a fresh page and writes, "Dear Mom and Dad." It's 5 minutes before he can come up with another line, but once he does, the words start flowing. And in strange directions, too. At first it's angry, as he knew it would be. How could you? Why did you? What kind of people could do this to their kid? Yet by the third page, it mellows. It becomes about all the good things that happened in their lives together. At first, he does it to hurt them, and to remind them exactly what they've thrown away when they signed the order to unwind him. But then it becomes all about remembering. Or, more to the point, getting them to remember. So that when he's gone, if he's gone, there will be a record of all the things he felt were worth keeping alive. When he started, he knew how the letter would end. "I hate you for what you've done, and I'll never forgive you." But when he finally reaches the 10th page, he finds himself writing, "I love you, your one-time son, Connor." Even before he signs his name, he feels the tears welling up inside. They don't seem to come from his eyes, but from deep in his gut. It's a heaving so powerful it hurts his stomach and his lungs. His eyes flood and the pain inside is so great, he's certain it will kill him right here, right now. But he doesn't die. And in time, the storm inside him passes, leaving him weak in every joint and muscle of his body. He feels like he needs Sonia's cane just to walk again. His tears have soaked into the pages, warping little craters in the paper but not smudging the ink. He folds the pages and slips them into the envelope, then seals and addresses it. He takes a few more minutes to make sure the storm won't come back, then he rings the little bell. Sonia steps in moments later. She must have been waiting all this time just on the other side of that curtain. Connor knows she must have heard him bawling, but she doesn't say a thing. She looks at his letter, hefts it in her hand to feel its weight, and raises her eyebrows, impressed. "Had a lot to say, did you?" Connor only shrugs. She puts the envelope face down on the table again. "Now I want you to put a date on the back. Write down the date of your 18th birthday." Connor doesn't question her anymore. He does as she asks. When he's done, she takes the envelope from him. "I'm going to hold this letter for you," she tells him. "If you survive to 18, you must promise that you'll come back here to get it. Will you make me that promise?" Connor nods. "I promise." She shakes the letter at him to help make her point. "I will keep this until a year after your 18th birthday. If you don't come back, I'll assume you didn't make it, that you were unwound. In that case, I'll send the letter myself." Then she hands the letter back to him, stands, and goes over to the old trunk that had covered the trap door. She opens the latch and, although it must be heavy, heaves open the lid to reveal envelopes, hundreds of them, filling the trunk almost up to the top. Leave it here, she says. It will be safe. If I die before you come back, Hannah has promised to take care of the trunk. Connor thinks of all the kids Sonya must have helped to have this many letters in her trunk, and he feels another wave of emotion taking hold of his gut. It doesn't quite bring him to tears, but it makes him feel all soft inside. Soft enough to say, "You've done something wonderful here." Sonya waves her hand, swatting the thought away. "You think this makes me a saint? Let me tell you, I've had a considerably long life, and I've done some pretty awful things, too." "Well, I don't care. No matter how many times you smack me with that cane, I think you're decent." "Maybe, maybe not. One thing you learn when you've lived as long as I have, people aren't all good, and people aren't all bad. We move in and out of darkness and light all of our lives. Right now, I'm pleased to be in the light." On his way downstairs, she makes sure to smack him on the butt with her cane, hard enough to sting, but it only makes him laugh. He doesn't tell Risa what's in store for her. Somehow telling her would be stealing something from her. Let this be between her, Sonya, the pen, and the page, as it had been for him. She leaves the baby with him as she goes up to face the old woman. It's asleep, and right now, in this place, and at this moment, there's something so comforting about holding it in his arms. He's thankful he saved it. And he thinks that if his soul had a form, this is what it would be. A baby sleeping in his arms. 20. Risa. The next time Sonya opens the trap door, Risa knows things are changing again. The time has come to leave the safety of Sonya's basement. Risa's the first in line when Sonya calls them to come up. Roland would have been, but Connor threw an arm out like a turnstile to let Risa get to the stairs first. With a sleeping baby crooked in her right arm and her left hand on the rusty steel banister, Risa climbs the jagged stone steps. Risa assumes she'll be climbing into daylight, but it's night. The lights are out in the shop. Just a few nightlights are on, carefully positioned so the kids can avoid the minefield of random antiques around them. Sonya leads them to a back door that opens into an alley. There's a truck waiting for them there. It's a small delivery truck. On its side is a picture of an ice cream cone. Sonya hadn't lied. It is the ice cream man. The driver stands beside the open back door of the truck. He's a scruffy guy who looks like he'd more likely be delivering illegal drugs than kids. Roland, Hayden, and Mai head for the truck, but Sonya stops Risa and Connor. "Not yet, you two." Then Risa notices a figure standing in the shadows. Risa's neck hairs begin to bristle defensively, but when the figure steps forward, she realizes who it is. It's Hannah, the teacher who saved them at the high school.
"Honey, the baby can't go where you're going," Hannah says.
Reflexively, Risa holds the baby closer to her. She doesn't even know why. All she's wanted to do since getting stuck with the thing is to get rid of it.
"It's all right," says Hannah. "I've talked it over with my husband. We'll just say we were storked. It'll be fine."
Risa looks in Hannah's eyes. She can't see all that well in the dim light, but she knows the woman means what she says. Connor, however, steps between them. "Do you want this baby?"
"She's willing to take it," says Risa. "That's enough."
"But does she want it? Did you want it?" That seems to give Connor pause for thought. Risa knows he didn't want it, but he had been willing to take it when the alternative was a miserable life with a miserable family. Just as Hannah is willing to save it from an uncertain future right now. Finally, Connor says,
"It's not an it, it's a she."
Then he heads off toward the truck.
"We'll give her a good home," Hannah says.
She takes a step closer, and Risa transfers the baby to her. The moment the baby is out of her arms, Risa feels a tremendous sense of relief, but also an indefinable sense of emptiness. It's a feeling not quite intense enough to leave her in tears, but strong enough to leave her with a phantom sort of aching. The type of thing an amputee must feel after losing a limb, That is, before a new one is grafted on.
You take care now, says Sonia, giving Risa an awkward hug. It's a long journey, but I know you can make it.
Journey to where? Sonia doesn't answer.
Hey, says the driver, I don't got all night.
Risa says goodbye to Sonia, nods to Hannah, and turns to join Connor, who's waiting for her at the back of the truck. As Risa leaves, the baby starts to cry, but she doesn't look back. She's surprised to find about a dozen other kids in the truck, all distrustful and scared. Roland's still the biggest, and he solidifies his position by making another kid move, even though there's plenty of other places to sit. The delivery truck is a hard, cold metal box. It once had a refrigeration unit to keep the ice cream cold, but that's gone along with the ice cream. Still, it's freezing in there, and it smells of spoiled dairy. The driver closes and locks the back doors, sealing out the sound of the baby, who Risa can still hear crying. Even after the door is closed, she thinks she can still hear it, although it's probably just her imagination. The ice cream truck bounces along the uneven streets. The way the truck sways, their backs are constantly smacked against the wall behind them. Risa closes her eyes. It makes her furious that she actually misses the baby. It was thrust upon her at the worst possible moment in her life. Why should she have any regret about being rid of it? She thinks about the days before the Heartland War, when unwanted babies could just be unwanted pregnancies, quickly made to go away. Did the women who made that other choice feel the way she felt now? Relieved and freed from an unwelcome and often unfair responsibility, yet vaguely regretful? In her days at the state home, when she was assigned to take care of the infants, she would often ponder such things. The infant wing had been massive and overflowing with identical cribs, each containing a baby that nobody had wanted. Wards of a state that could barely feed them, much less nurture them.
You can't change laws without first changing human nature, one of the nurses often said as she looked out over the crowd of crying infants. Her name was Greta.
Whenever she said something like that, there was always another nurse within earshot who was far more accepting of the system and would counter with, You can't change human nature without first changing the law. Nurse Greta wouldn't argue. She'd just grunt and walk away. Which was worse, Risa often wondered, to have tens of thousands of babies that no one wanted, or to silently make them go away before they were even born? On different days, Risa had different answers. Nurse Greta was old enough to remember the days before the war, but she rarely spoke of them. All her attention was given to her job, which was a formidable one, since there was only one nurse for every 50 babies.
In a place like this, you have to practice triage, she told Risa, referring to how, in an emergency, a nurse had to choose which patients would get medical attention. Love the ones you can, Nurse Greta told her. Pray for the rest.
Risa took the advice to heart and selected a handful of favorites to give extra attention. These were the ones Risa named herself, instead of letting the randomizing computer name them. Risa liked to think she had been named by a human being instead of a computer. After all, her name wasn't all that common.
It's short for sonrisa, a Hispanic kid once told her. That's Spanish for smile.
Risa didn't know if she had any Hispanic blood in her, but she liked to think she did. It connected her to her name.
What are you thinking about? Connor asks, tearing her out of her thoughts and bringing her back to the uneasy reality around them. None of your business?
Connor doesn't look at her. He seems to be focusing on a big rust spot on the wall, thinking,
You okay about the baby? He asks.
Of course. Her tone is intentionally indignant, as if the question itself offended her.
Hannah will give her a good home, Connor says. Better than us, that's for sure. And better than that beady-eyed cow who got storked.
He hesitates for a moment, then says,
Taking that baby was a massive screw-up, I know. But it ended okay for us, right? And it definitely ended better for the baby.
Don't screw up like that again, is all Risa says. Roland, sitting toward the front, turns to the driver and asks,
Where are we going? You're asking the wrong guy, the driver answers. They give me an address, I go there. I look the other way, and I get paid.
This is how it works, says another kid who had already been in the truck when it arrived at Sonia's. We get shuffled around. One safe house for a few days, then another, and then another. Each one is a little bit closer to where we're going.
Are you going to tell us where that is? Asks Roland.
The kid looks around, hoping someone else might answer for him, but no one comes to his aid. So he says,
Well, it's only what I hear, but they say we end up in a place called the graveyard.
No response from the kids, just the rattling of the truck. The graveyard. The thought of it makes Risa even colder. Even though she's curled up knees to chest, arms wrapped tight around her like a straitjacket, she's still freezing.
Connor must hear the chattering of her teeth because he puts his arm around her.
I'm cold too, he says. Body heat, right?
And although she has an urge to push him away, she finds herself leaning into him until she can feel his heartbeat in her ears.
Part 3. Transit. 2003. Ukrainian Maternity Hospital Number 6. The BBC has spoken to mothers from the city of Kharkiv who say they gave birth to healthy babies only to have them taken by maternity staff. In 2003, the authorities agreed to exhume around 30 bodies from a cemetery used by Maternity Hospital Number 6. One campaigner was allowed into the autopsy to gather video evidence. She has given that footage to the BBC and Council of Europe. In its report, the Council describes a general culture of trafficking of children snatched at birth, and a wall of silence from hospital staff upward over their fate. The pictures show organs, including brains, have been stripped, and some bodies dismembered. A senior British forensic pathologist says he is very concerned to see bodies in pieces, as that is not standard post-mortem practice. It could possibly be a result of harvesting stem cells from bone marrow. Hospital Number 6 denies the allegations. Story by Matthew Hill, BBC health correspondent, from BBC News at bbc.com. http://news.bbc.co.uk/go/pr/fr/-2/hi/europe/617-1083.stm. Published 2006/12/12/093450 GMT. Copyright BBC 2006. 21. Lev.
Ain't no one gonna tell you what's in your heart, he tells Lev. You gotta find that out for yourself.
Lev and his new travel companion walk along train tracks, surrounded by thick, brushy terrain.
You got it in your heart to run from unwinding? Ain't no one can tell you it's the wrong thing to do, even if it is against the law. The good Lord wouldn't have put it in your heart if it wasn't right. You listening, Fry? 'Cause this here is wisdom. Wisdom you can take to the grave, then dig it up again when you need some solace. Solace, that means comfort.
I know what solace means, says Lev, peeved by the mention of the good Lord, who hasn't done much for Lev lately, except confuse things. The kid is 15, and his name is Cyrus Finch, although he doesn't go by that name.
No one calls me Cyrus, he had told Lev shortly after they met. I go by Sci-Fi.
And since Sci-Fi is partial to nicknames, he calls Lev Fry, short for Small Fry. Since it has the same number of letters as Lev, he says it's appropriate. Lev doesn't want to burst his bubble by pointing out that his full name is Levi. Sci-Fi enjoys hearing himself talk.
I make my own roads in life, he tells Lev. That's how come we're traveling the rails instead of some dumb old country road.
Sci-Fi is umber.
They used to call us black. Can you imagine? Then there was this artist dude, mixed race himself. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. He got famous, though, for painting people of African ancestry in the Deep South. The color he used most was umber. People liked that a whole lot better, so it stuck. Bet you didn't know where the word came from, did you, Fry? Following right along, they started calling so-called white people Sienna. After another paint color. Better words. Didn't have no value judgment to them. Of course, it's not like racism is gone completely. But as my dad's like to say, the veneer of civilization got itself a second coat.